May 16th, 2010, is the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sawat from Pedro show, and I'm not in Pedro, I'm in Santa Monica in at Track 16 Gallery, and we first heard some John Coltrane there. That was his last tour in Japan with a song called Peace on Earth. His wife, Alice, and Pharoah Sanders, Rashid Ali, not the classic quartet, but his last. And then we heard something, Calm Down, Friend, by Telepathic Friend. I'm not sure where they're from, but they sent me some music and I liked it. And I got Christine McKenna here, and I'm going to talk to her.
Should I start?
Or, yeah.
What's the first record you ever bought?
I think it was a 45 American Woman, the Guess Who.
Oh, really?
Yeah, pretty terrible.
Yeah? No, that's actually a good song. The Butthole Surfers did a great version of it.
Yeah, better one.
Yeah. The Grassroots started in about 68, and that was about their third hit.
No, Guess Who?
Oh.
It was a Canadian band.
Oh, right. That was their only hit, wasn't it?
They had some other ones like No Sugar Tonight.
Yeah.
Burton Cummins. They had they had a lot of hits.
Yeah.
I think it was in the late 60s.
Yeah. Well, what about an album, A Bigger Commitment?
Yeah. I had this little record player that didn't have the little thing. It only had the fat thing for the 45, so that's what I got. And they only cost a dollar. They were really cheap. And records were like $3 or $4.
Yeah.
I think it was Are You Experience.
Oh. That's very hip, first choice.
For an album.
Yeah.
And then, it was weird. I couldn't play it because it was only a fat thing for 45s. So I was going to have to get a record player. I got it just because I knew someone else did. I couldn't play it. I just did it to belong, like, so stupid. So what I did was, a new thing was just coming called 8-track. And so I got 8-track cartridges, which were very strange.
I remember those.
I went to go get albums later, but for a few years when I was just becoming a teenager.
Well, you were a teenager when the first wave of punk was happening in L.A., right?
Yeah, I was... I graduated in 76. I was 18.
So were you coming up to L.A. to see shows?
The drummer of the Weirdos is from Pedro.
Nicky Beat?
Uh-huh.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he was walking around. They were just closing down the Fort MacArthur. Me and D. Boone used to jam with his guy, Mark Weisswasser. They rented out the rec room as they were closing the thing down. They tore it all up. It slips for boats now. It was lower reservation. But Nicky Beat was walking around there with the Kotex around his neck. Like
those were the days.
Like a necklace kind of thing. And he told us about this scene in Hollywood where people played their own songs. And went up there and saw him play Weirdos.
Weirdos were great.
And all those bands, Bags and Germs. And found out that some lived by us, like Alley Cats. We're in Alameda, actually, and Suburban Lawns were in Long Beach. I rode my bike to Hollywood when
from
I was
Pedro?
15. Yeah.
Oh.
I got a car when I was 16, so I didn't ride bike anymore. But the first time I went to Hollywood was when I was 15, and I rode a bike. And I went up the west side, went to the Strand, and all those beach towns, and then worked my way over once I hit Santa Monica.
What was there in town that you just felt you had to get to?
I just wanted to see what it was like.
Yeah.
And it didn't look much different.
When you think back on that, which band stands out in your mind is really
amazing? When I was going for gigs, well, this is what I was getting to. All I knew about Hollywood was that one bike trip. And then, like Nikki tells us about these gigs, and we start going up there and seeing shows. Because before that, my first gig was T-Rex. It was Arena Rock. I'd never been to a club. So Nikki, you know, tells us about this scene, and it's in clubs. And we had never seen rock and roll in clubs. So that was all new to us. Hollywood, I didn't know it as much as I don't know, as a place. It's a scene of all these different people. It seemed all, when I went and talked, the people at the gigs were very open, but they were also very bizarre and singular kind of characters, you know. And you could, they were all from different places. You talked to them, like none were from Pedro, hardly, except Nikki. But they were from all these different parts of L.A. that I didn't really know of. So it wasn't Hollywood so much as a place, a home grown people. It was these people from other parts of SoCal coming to meet there. Mm-hmm. And that was very interesting because I didn't really know Pedro people since than there since I moved there. So it was the first time I was getting to know other people from SoCal.
Were you and Dee Boone already writing songs at that point?
When we went to those gigs?
Mm-hmm.
No. No, we didn't write songs at all. When we first started playing, it was just after school and like stuff like American Woman to riff over and over again for hours and copying, trying to copy Creedence and The Who and Alice Cooper, Blue Oyster Cult, but whatever, who was simple enough to learn off the record. Never thought of music as a way to express. It was like building models or something. Kind of looked like it, sort of. The gigs were, I mean, if you went to an arena rock gig, you could never imagine playing one of those things. It was much different when we went and saw those bands in Hollywood. That scene looked like you could play. And you could tell that they were writing their own songs, and in fact, they were just getting started. It didn't like seem like they were waiting to play a long time in the bedroom, copying other people's songs. So we liked that, and that's when we thought we should try to write songs.
The Minutemen started gigging when, about 1980?
Yeah, well, we had a band called The Reactionaries before that, where we started trying to write songs.
Was George Hurley the same lineup?
George Hurley was a drummer, but there was a fourth guy. Mm-hmm. And that's where we first tried to write songs. In 1978, we started the band. And I don't know, by the summer of 79, we Dee Boone wanted to stop it and make another band. So in January of 80, we made Minutemen. Mm-hmm. And tried to be more original with our sound. We weren't so original. Well, we didn't know what to do with Reactionaries. A lot of it sounds like those bands we were seeing in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. We didn't have experience writing. And Minutemen didn't have George Hurley at first. They had a welder from our town named Frank Tonchi. And he's from a polka band. And after two gigs, he got scared and quit.
Yeah.
And left his drums.
Yeah.
I saw him years later, and he told me he should have never done that. He should have stayed.
Yeah. Yeah. You've talked a lot about how important Dee Boone was to you. What was so inspiring about
him? Georgie helped
for you?
Us too, because when Frank left, Greg Ginn had asked to make a record, so we had no drummer, and then Georgie learned all the songs in like a month.
Yeah.
Dee Boone was about music. About what?
Just
Man?
I
mean, I wouldn't be doing music without him. When I met him, that's the way we hung out. His mother had me play bass. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know what a bass was. You know, I didn't have ideas about playing. I tried it in school. They gave me the clarinet after 10 weeks, seventh grade. Teacher told me to stop. He said I tried hard, but didn't.
Yeah.
So I got into music to be with him, and so and we had no idea, really, we didn't know what to do with it except to share it with each other, just to stuff to do, like when you're boys, you know. Mm-hmm. So I have to give him a lot of the credit for me being in this, in the music racket.
Mm-hmm. You said in your wonderful book, Spiels of the Minutemen, you made the point that personal connections and relations were more important than the music for you. Do you still feel that way?
Well, with the because I'm not a musician. I got into it to be with my friend. But, I mean, I've been doing it a while. How can I put it? Like, we're talking right now. There are professional talkers, right? But that doesn't mean other people can talk. So that's kind of what I did with the music. Now, he got killed, which was a terrible thing for me. And I really didn't want to think... I really didn't think people wanted to see me play without him. So I kind of stopped. And some people helped me. Thurston got me playing again. Not after very long either. They wanted me, he had me on a record with him. So I started doing it again without him. And I just kept going.
Yeah, really.
But the personal, even getting back, see, that was Thurston. That was a person thing. It wasn't so much music kind of thing. I guess I could pursue music. I have been doing it long enough now. I could pursue it as music.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of keeping going, it seems like you have a gig every night of the year. What have you had to sacrifice in your life to be as involved with music as you are?
Like touring?
Yeah, it seems like you're always on the road, and when you're here, you're doing shows.
Well, you know, my father was a sailor, and he was never home because of the Vietnam War and that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of hated that. But then I guess I ended up kind of the same thing.
Definitely. Yeah.
Punk Navy.
Yeah.
So I couldn't have a family, really. Mm-hmm. I didn't want that to happen. To a son or daughter, or father never home. Because that was my experience.
Mm-hmm.
When I got in my 20s and stuff, I got started to get to know him again.
Dad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I could go up there. Yeah, he retired to Fresno, and so I'd go up and see him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
What was he like?
And he's a chief. Chief's like a sergeant,
mm-hmm.
if it was Army. But he didn't yell that much. Not like the other ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was very, weighed his words. You'd talk with big pauses. And he ran away to the Navy when he was 17. But
what
that's how he saw the world.
What did he run away from?
He has a little farm town. And it's not happening for him. And plus he could see stuff. Which I could relate to him because that's how I got to see stuff was touring.
Mm-hmm.
And we could, when I was a boy, he'd come home, you know, for a little while and he'd take me driving and tell me about all he saw for hours and hours. And then I got to the point where I could tell him about my tours.
Did he understand your music?
He only saw me play once.
And where was that gig?
He was in Fresno.
And how was it?
At a spaghetti factory.
Yeah. How was it?
I had fever.
Oh.
And sometimes you got to play sick. And
yeah.
He conked at his pad, and he was really happy. He didn't have music people in his family. The whole music thing for him was trippy. He thought it was something I did with D. Boone. He didn't know. In fact, I was keep going.
Yeah.
So I started sending him postcards from tour.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, wow, you're like a sailor. Couldn't believe all these towns I was playing. He had no idea. And then my sister gave him some of my records. I never talked to him about the things. There was a weird thing when we were when I was a boy, maybe 19, 18, and the punk came for me and getting into the scene, and it was very minority thing, and especially for somebody like my father in the Navy and have no idea. And he came to talk to me. He came to Pedro. He got a beer, a six pack of beer, drank beers with. And then it came to the thing, you know, he's going to ask me, so what's this punk shit about?
Yeah.
You know, what's this? And I told him, well, yeah, me and D. Boone are going to write our own songs and play gigs and, you know, put out a record. And he was like, yeah, yeah, well, what's it all about, though, really?
Uh-huh.
And I go, what do you mean, you know? And he goes, is it socialist? That's what I did. I laughed. There was a chair there, and he grabbed the leg, because we're sitting on the deck, and he grabs the leg of the chair And he looked at me. He had hazel eyes, but they would get gray when he was pissed. It was like slate. His eyes were like slate. And then he just let go of that chair. And I didn't mean to laugh at him. You know, I just didn't expect that. You know,
you kind of was socialist, though, if you read the lyrics.
Yeah, but my pop... but he was thinking, I think, more like... treason or something.
Right. Or I see.
Hippie,
the military.
Things might have gone up. Uh-huh. Well, he had some weird things about the military, especially when he retired. He wanted to go protest Oliver North.
Really?
Yeah, he was going through a lot of change. He joined really young, you know. So, he was a guy who voted for Nixon and Reagan the first time, but not the second. He was really angry at this North guy.
Was he interested in music?
My pop? I told you, he didn't know anything about
it. No, your music, but did he listen to jazz or any, you know, pop music?
He had some. He was into Mills Brothers, I know that.
I saw
some of his
bad.
Stuff.
Yeah.
And but he didn't know firsthand musician people, music lifestyles of people. I mean, I didn't either until I started playing around with them and, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed a lot of cats in bands had music people in their family. The mother, a little bit. Her daddy did some vaudeville. He told me some interesting tour stories. $2 or $3 a night, you know.
Wow.
People chucking shit at him. And
what was his... Did he have
an
instrument?
He played guitar, and a boy would sing with him, so they were a duet. Vaudeville would have a whole bunch of things. You'd have jugglers and people doing poems and comedy and music, too. And so he'd be part of these traveling... shows. He did a little of that, not a long time, but so I have a little bit of music, but not on my father's side at all. So I don't know. I never asked him about how I rated with my own stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
What's your favorite Minutemen song?
I don't know, history lesson.
Really? Why?
I guess. I never thought about my music. Because it was me trying to relate to some younger hardcore kids about me and D. Boone. And I thought that said a lot about our band for them in the moment.
How did you meet Greg Ginn and Raymond and get involved with all the SST people?
At gigs.
Yeah?
Yeah, in fact, they were having their second gig and they're handing out flyers. When the Clash played over here at
Santa Monica Civic, yeah.
The Dills and Bo Diddley. And we saw this flyer, and it was like they were going to have a punk gig in Pedro, and we couldn't believe that. And they asked why, and said, because we're a punk band in Pedro, and they couldn't believe there was a punk band in Pedro, so they asked us to open up. So that's how we met them. And, yeah, a couple months later, we were SST-002, so it was by accident. Mm-hmm.
Why has Raymond been such an important teacher for you? You've talked a lot about...
He knows a lot.
But what did he know about that meant a lot to you? I mean, he knows a lot about economics. Is that interesting to you?
The way he does it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he went to school for. But he don't talk a lot about economics. Sometimes. He can talk about anything and it's interesting for me.
Yeah, he's very brilliant.
He has insight. And he's funny, and he's just taught me a lot. He knew a lot more than me about artistic things. I think I know some stuff. Learn him some stuff too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You don't know sometimes.
When you first started playing with Iggy, were you intimidated by him?
Intimidated. I wanted to do good for him. Yeah, he's, I mean, the whole Stooges thing was an intense experience for me because, you know, that music was big for a punk scene. Like when I went up to Hollywood and met all those people out of town who didn't know shit about them, one thing in common was Stooges. That was trippy, how everybody liked them. Because when... my town, when we were young, everyone hated them. And here was a scene everybody loved. So everybody knew these songs, music. And then, yeah, I'm going to play those songs with them. It was because of Ronnie. Ronnie brought me in.
Oh, how did you know him?
Ronnie actually came to my gigs when I come play Detroit.
Oh.
This guy named the Colonel Brown. There was a movie Todd Haynes made called Velvet Goldmine.
Love that movie.
And he wanted... There's a kind of a Bowie guy, and there's a guy who's kind of egg crossed with Kurt Cobain. It should have been all egg, maybe, but for some, maybe because of those days, I don't know, that guy's kind of mixed. But they wanted some music of Stooges, so people helping them with the music said, hey, we know Ron Ashton. And so they set Steve Shelley out there to, because he's Michigan, but Midland. But he went out there and played drums with Ronnie. He got some songs together. They brought him to New York, and they asked me to play the bass. And we did music for that movie.
Are you in the band? Like when
no,
you
we were making the music.
Oh.
We're not being filmed.
Yeah.
We just made music.
So you did the music like when he performs TVI and
that's
that
us.
Stuff?
That's
me. Oh, okay.
So that's when I first got to record with Ronnie. Then... a few years later, the sickness almost killed me, and they had to put tubes in me and shit.
Mm-hmm.
These doctors misdiagnosed me. The county doctor saved my life, but they had to put tubes in me, so I couldn't play bass. And it was the first time I had to stop since I started. And so when I tried to do it again, I couldn't.
How long did you have to stop? Shit.
I don't know, like 8 months, something like that. And I atrophied. I couldn't play. And I was kind of panicked, so I started doing Stooges songs to get strong. There's not a lot of chord changes. Maybe a little more with James Williamson. But especially those first two albums, it was a lot of feel, so it helped me get strong. And right at the same time, Jay Mascis was making a solo album, and he asked me to play the bass on a tour, and he said oh no, that happens after I ask him to do them. Yeah, not only am I playing the songs, I want to make some copy bands. I go back to my youth, but just do Stooges. So I asked him and the Dinosaur drummer Murph to do some, and I did some out west here too with Perkins and Peter from Porno for Pyros. And then he asked me to do this, and he said it was hard for him to sing every song every night, so why don't we do some Stooges? And we came through Ann Arbor, and he asked me to call up Ronnie. So I did, and he came down there to Blind Pig, and we jammed with him, and Jay took him on tour. And we were playing the last third of the set with Stooges songs with Ron Ashton. And then Thurston was curating some Altamar party and asked to get his brother was living in his truck, so he rented some drums. And so me and Jay are playing with both the Ashton brothers Stooges songs, you know. And Egg heard about this, and he asked them to play on his Skull Ring album. And then I was on tour, and my second man was in Tallahassee. I got a call, and it was Egg, and he said, Ronnie says you're the man. So I flew over to Coachella and did that gig with him.
Oh, I remember that show.
Yeah, so 7 years. So I've actually been damn longer than I was a Minuteman now.
How is Iggy different from people's... he has a certain public image. Is he different from that, really?
What's his public image?
Wild.
Yeah, he's wild.
Yeah.
But he's very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
They're all very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Him with culture, Ronnie was with history, and Scotty with nature,
mm-hmm.
Steve McKay in politics. When Egg's on stage, I mean, he's kind of, out of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, he hears everything. He knows. He's like a conductor. It's a duality.
Mm-hmm.
He's, all of them, they're Midwest guys, you know, they're very plain speaking. They're not so much jive talk.
Mm-hmm.
He reminds me of my pop a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Scotty too. Scotty even more stoic. Not just
yeah.
Very careful with the words, and
matter of fact. And, you know, I'm young in that band, you know. They're 60s guys. I was only a boy in the 60s, so it's very interesting for me to be around them. That whole different sensibility. Mm-hmm. I'm 11 years younger than Ig, but he's from another time. They're responsible for punk thing, but they're not us.
Right. Yeah.
Different, but very important to us. I can't imagine us even having a scene without that band. So I feel big responsibility when I'm playing with them as far as their legacy, and mm-hmm. I owe them all the good I can do. Your music anyway, really.
Do you guys write new songs together as a band?
They made an album in 2006, and I played the bass on it.
But were you part of the writing process?
No, they had already the songs. They had done them in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then I came on after.
Yeah.
They brought me in. In fact, he took me to his house for 3 days.
In Florida?
Yeah, and rented me a kayak. Mm-hmm. And took me to the beach, laid out in the sea. He goes, "Hey, you ever wear shorts?" He never seen me in shorts. Took me to the beach and laid in the sun with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was interesting. And then went over every song, and he came up with bass ideas.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I play with them and try my hardest, but I'm not the Stooges. I'm mm-hmm. kind of stepson or something.
Yeah. Are there areas of music that you're interested in that you haven't really explored yet?
Yeah. The bass.
Well, I
it's
mean,
got
like
a lot more to
free
deal
jazz,
with.
Country music. Seems like you've done a lot.
I've done some stuff like that. It's scary. I've done pop music. I've done reggae.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Who'd you do reggae with?
I did one of these, what were they called? Sublime.
Oh.
I did some of their stuff. I was asked to do a tribute. Genres of music. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of that to me is about marketing. Music is music, and you take yourself to different places that are challenging. Mm-hmm. It's more natural. Music doesn't really know about styles. Styles are up to people, and they get quantified in these kind of genre things. But again, I think that's from marketing. So any place I can put myself on the bass and I can learn stuff is interesting for me. No, I think we're at the end of the first hour, though, and I should switch this over. Not that incredible.
Well, yeah, it is.
It's May 16th, 2010, the second hour of the Watt from Pedro show. documented
that. What are you going to play next?
Oh, I just played some music. I played Get Me to the World from Instant Party. I Love Your Eyes by Drunken Instrument Corporation. A lot of this stuff I play is from young people making their own music. I don't really play commercial stuff. Then Big Time Bum, Love My Dead Cock. This is Stooges. Somebody gave this to me in London. There's a little period after Funhouse where James Williamson and Ronnie are both playing guitar. A guy named Jimmy Ricker was on the bass. So that's where that's from. And then something from Bass Country this guy sent me called Flesh and Bones by Moby Dick.
So people are sending you music all the time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or after gigs? People hand me their things. It's much different than the old days when it took money to go into studio. It's very cheap right now to make your own music or record it. And very interesting.
How often do you find surprising, interesting things?
All the time.
Yeah?
Yeah, I try to keep open mind about it.
Yeah.
Not have somebody figure it out until I hear their music.
Yeah.
Even the band name.
Somebody
with a bad band name could have some good music. Yeah,
yeah,
like I met these cats in Tokyo. They're called Light, L-I-T-E. That's got to be the worst name you could ever have for your band.
Yeah, it's bad.
I told them about it. They're young. They're in their 20s. I say, there's, you know, Miller actually owns a copyright on them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the other Light the beers word? Have to be spelled L-I-G-H-T. But they
silly.
Yeah, but they didn't know, you know. They didn't even know it was about beer, you know. It was like lights.
Yeah.
But they don't really have our alphabet, so they didn't know. But they're a really good band. Maybe like kind of Stephen Reich and Television Come On or something. They're very interesting. So I don't even try to judge by the band name or how people look or anything. I just listen. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of good stuff. I'm never hurting for music to play on this show.
Yeah.
I'm not really trying to play stuff people expect to hear. It's stuff that I like, but it's not stuff I make. You know, it's been given to me. So
most of the music today is young bands, new music from young bands.
Well, the Stooges ain't that young.
Do you have Stooges in there?
Yeah, I just told you I played this version with Ronnie and James both. Because everybody thinks that when James Williamson was in the band, Ronnie went to bass. Mm-hmm. But actually, there's a period where they're both on guitar. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was one gig where, see, this is a great thing being with him. You get to hear all these stories. But Steve McKay played the drums because Scotty took the truck under a bridge. Well, he didn't get through it because the bridge was too low. And he went flying through the windshield and all, busted up his face, and the other guys riding with him. So they had a duke with Steve. Steve didn't really know drums, so he'd have to run up there and show him how the song started and start pounding on it. But there's this weird period in the first part of 1971 where there's both these guys on guitar. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting. I guess there was, seven or eight gigs, and somebody's put together like a five-disc thing. They got tapes of these shows. Yeah.
How good are the tapes?
Yeah.
Who
you
cares?
You can tell by hearing it and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, in those days, people going to gigs or something, cassette tapes probably. I remember myself, first tapes I made, not at gigs, but there'd be TV shows like In Concert or Don Kirshner, and I would tape it right from the TV with these, you know, the two buttons you push down.
Uh-huh.
You'd hear this huge-ass hum and...
Uh-huh.
So, but that's all there was in those days.
Yeah.
Now we just did these... Stooges played in London at the... It used to be called the Odeon, but Hammersmith Apollo. And when the gig was over, they were selling the gig on a USB stick.
Wow.
Right there.
Do you think that's a good thing?
Why not?
Because part of the romance of music for me is that you hear about a show and you know you weren't there, and It gets extra power.
You never bought a live album?
I generally don't like live albums.
Oh, because that's what this is like.
Yeah.
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 It's a live album. But like right there, right when you get done playing it.
That's
it's scary.
Yeah.
I blew one clam, it was at the end, you know. Fuck. Now, you know, of course, I'm going to always hear that.
Mm-hmm.
When you know you're being recorded like that, it's kind of scary. There was one in Lille, France, too, week before. So we've already had two gigs that are out you can get. Let alone those old days when they were, scouring for bootleg. Yeah, that's what happens anyway, right? There's bootlegs. It's not like these things don't get out.
Mm-hmm. So why not? Are the Stooges on a label?
No. No.
So who put out Skull Ring?
Skull Ring and The Weirdness, that Stooges album, those came out on, what's it called? EMI?
So they do have a record deal.
No, I think it was Ig or something.
Yeah.
I don't really know. Was that a one-off thing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So he's kind of in charge of his own career now as opposed to being...
Now? Ig was a solo guy for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last gig is that Metallic KO one.
Mm-hmm.
That's the last gig. There's no more Stooges after that. After that, it's all Ig. And right away... He did that Kill City thing with James. Actually, those were just demos, but it helped him get a record deal. He started way back then and kept going. How many solo albums? 15, 20?
Yeah,
he's got a lot.
He made a lot of records.
Right. So he's been in charge of his own career. He didn't really talk with those guys a lot in between, but I can tell when he started, especially with the Ashton Brothers, he really liked playing with them again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then they were a team,
right.
three people. It wasn't like he's bossing them around or anything, not at all.
Does Iggy know the Minutemen music?
Ig knows about a lot of music.
Mm-hmm.
He knows about more current music than I do.
Yeah.
He's very engaged with culture. He's very aware. He's not hermit.
Have you ever read his autobiography? That one,
I Need More. Yeah.
It's so genius. I love that book. He's very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he wrote it with some lady.
Yeah.
Right?
Don't you have a musical liaison with somebody in Italy? Didn't you just make a record over there?
Yeah, I did. In November.
Who were those people that you were
playing
with?
They're younger guys, 30-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Stefano Paglia, Andrea Belfi. And I went over there and did six gigs and made an album. It's almost finished. It's been being mixed now.
What's it called?
Il Sogno del Marinaio.
And what's the
group means,
called?
That's the name of the group. And it means a sailor's dream.
Oh.
Yeah, Marinaro, like Marinaro.
Uh-huh.
Marinaro, huh?
Yeah.
Marinaro.
Yeah.
Their thing, sueño, sogno, Italian and Spanish, they're close.
Yeah.
Stefano was from Genoa, which was a sailor town. I don't know, we came up with that idea for it. I had never played with them before. Actually, the internet has changed a lot of this kind of stuff for me where I can just play with people. I just made an album with the guy in Canada. I never even met this guy.
That is so weird.
Send me these songs that I played on it.
What
about
the vibe, the magic between you and
me? Yeah, you listen to it and you try to... It's music for music. That's all it is just sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even know the man. I don't even know what he looks like.
What motivated you to want to do it? You just like the music?
I was telling you before, if I could put my bass in a place... where it's challenging, I'm going to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to do. He just seemed very genuine and not about anything except like, hey, here's my music. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, yeah, okay. I'll do it. And he gave me 10 songs and I put the bass on it. And
God,
it's called
great.
The Lighthouse.
Mm-hmm.
and the album's called Channels. And so I'd take the songs one at a time and listen to them and see, well, what can I do with this here? And I'd try working bass part to it, and I'd send it back to them.
Wow. How did the kayaking thing
to me, it's a lot more pure than maybe the social thing.
Uh-huh.
Social thing, of course, has got its place. Like that, those Italianos, one of them rode in a truck with me, in the van with me, when I did a tour in Italy 5 years ago, and that's all I knew him for. I didn't really know he played music and stuff. Actually, him and Andrea are from avant-garde kind of school of music. So I just thought, whoa, my mama's people are from Italy. It was just great. They cooked for me every day.
Wow.
Yeah. It was just great, you know, and they played their hearts out. And the way I got into music was an accident and uncomplicated, and I don't see why that should change so much. What about the kayak?
Well, how did you? What made me think of it is you did this record in Italy, A Sailor's Dream. The Canadian record was The Lighthouse. They both have sort of nautical themes. And how did you get involved with the kayak, which was a crucial part of the photographs you're taking?
Yeah, well, I told you I rode up to Hollywood on a bicycle when I was 15. When I was 16, I got a car. And I stopped riding bicycle. I didn't ride bicycle again for 22 years, because I thought it was for little kids. And I was just fucked up. This guy was moving to Atlanta, and he sold me a 10-speed for $5.
Wow.
Yeah, and I just remembered seeing so many people's pads, bicycles as clothes racks. And I said, I'm not going to let that happen, so I'm going to ride this thing. Now, I got terrible knees. And I did it. I started writing music. I wrote my first opera on it. You know, I started listening. It was just way different. I ride way early in the morning. But I have bad knees. I had surgeries on my knees in my early 20s. And every day was starting to really hurt them. Actually made them stronger in some ways, but in other ways, you know, they're like cassava melons. Mm. So I thought about, well, I had a friend named Marty who do these dragon boat things, you know, these outriggers, Catalina. Like, I didn't want to do that, I mean, that's too much. But here's the harbor, and what about a kayak, you know? Because it's all waist above, and I'm by the water here, and I love the water. And my father made me learn how to sail when I was a teenager and shit. But then that's too much trouble. But with the kayak, I could just stick it in the van, you know, and always have it and just go out there. And I could alternate the days of being on a bicycle. So it would give my knees a break. So I've been doing that about 8 years.
Wow.
So, and it's its own thing. It's different than the bike. I mean, it's about rhythm. It's about listening. It's about being aware. The sea is very intense. You have to have respect for it.
You never go out to sea, though.
I do.
Like, how far?
I always go out to sea.
How far?
You know, out of the breakwater. Sometimes I go on the ocean side and I go straight out in. But when you're in a kayak, you're pretty low, so if there's any kind of surf.
I don't like the sound of that.
Wow. Oh, yeah, a lot of people are scared. They think you roll over and stuff.
Have you ever been scared out there?
Yeah. A little bit, because if the sea can turn scary fast.
Yeah.
You have to have big respect. And it's, you can't be too scared, though, because that'll give you problems. So you have to have respect, but don't panic. But when she gets all big and heavy and is like heaving you, it's intense.
Have you ever been thrown out of your boat?
No.
Okay, good.
No. The paddle is kind of like a balance bar. And you don't have to worry about flipping over. I mean, mine, if that happened, it would swamp anyway, because it has a big hole. It would fill up with water. Those are for little ones, I guess, with a skirt. And there's different kinds of kayaks. But people, once they try it, they see how different it is than their preconceptions. It's actually a lot more enjoyable.
Yeah.
And not so scary. But you still have to have respect. I always use a life jacket.
You never listen to an iPod when you're out there, do you?
No, why?
Well, I don't know. You see people with iPods everywhere, I wondered.
No, but one of the things is about listening. Mm-hmm. Same with the bicycle. I didn't really listen before, you know. So there's nature, a lot of man too, because it's harbor, so there's a lot of the work in the harbor going on. I don't know, it's just trippy to listen to. It's a couple hours of my morning on the bike or the kayak, so I can get to that other stuff later.
Yeah.
But there's the little nature. San Pedro too, the way it is, its geography is more lucky than maybe Silver Lake or something, West Hollywood.
Lucky.
Yeah, for geography, for nature, for trees and cliffs and harbor, you know what I mean? So we have that in my town.
Yeah. Do you think you'll ever live anywhere else?
I don't know if I wanna.
Well, then you don't have to.
Okay. I like visiting everywhere.
Yeah, you do, constantly.
Yeah. Last year was my 61st tour.
Do you ever not feel like doing that?
Touring?
Yeah, do you ever just think, ugh, I don't want to do it?
No, it's an adventure. Mm-hmm. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, but I like having Pedro Town, but I like seeing other people's towns and meeting other people and it's the only way one time I took 3 days and I went to Dublin for the Ulysses Centennial.
Oh, wow.
I went to a town without playing a gig.
Yeah.
Not much.
How did it feel?
Trippy.
Yeah.
Yeah, also a lot of I was caught up in the thing though, because a lot of the stuff in the book is there. Mm-hmm. I could walk there. That was a big book for me when I was
younger. It's a huge book. What are you reading now?
I used to be what I'm reading now, he's an Irish it's funny you mentioned, he's an Irish author, Paul McGarren is his name, and The Sun Rises. An Irish guy living in Tokyo gave it to me when I was there, and it's written very slow, very pastoral. Mm-hmm. Interesting. The Irish still really have a command on the English language. Yeah. And just before that, I did Tommy Pynchon's new one.
Inherent Vice.
Inherent Vice, the detective one.
Did
with
you
hippies.
Like it?
It was funny.
Yeah.
Kind of like... Crying a lot, 49 a little bit.
Yeah.
More funny.
Yeah. You know, you write really well. Do you plan to, have you thought about doing a book?
No.
The writing in your book is great.
I write diaries. Uh-huh. You know, I don't know about, I love reading, I love writers, they're a big inspiration to me, but I don't know about doing it. Yeah, it seems I have a lot to do on bass. Maybe if my hands got hurt.
Oh, that's a horrible thought.
Yeah, but I mean,
life is life.
My pop, he's always said, "Have a Bravo."
Yeah.
Have a Plan B. Yeah. So I've thought about it. What would happen if my hands got hurt?
What would you do?
Maybe write. So maybe doing the diary is practice. I don't know.
I think that's a good idea. When you listen to your really early music, how does it sound to you now?
Like the Reactionaries?
Yeah.
It just, we really put that out. It's pretty terrible.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
Pretty embarrassing. I didn't know what I was fucking doing. I didn't.
But the spirit must be very pure.
Yeah, well, I can't believe D. Boone tolerated it. He's a very open-minded man. Of course, he was saving all his songs for the next band. Uh-huh. for Minutemen.
Yeah.
I didn't know, so it was me putting up all these corny, crummy songs. But you gotta start somewhere, and I just didn't know, you know.
Did you say
some of the Minutemen stuff really amazes me? I can't believe I was part of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty trippy for me.
So the Reactionaries, that was just released?
Yeah, because we only made one practice tape.
And that's it.
Actually, there was two tapes. Yeah, we made this guy Joe Sindicich came in and recorded us in the practice pad behind George Hurley's ma's house, and I made two cassettes from it. And I kept one, and I gave one to Brandon. It was the first time we actually asked somebody to do gigs, and I never heard from him. He couldn't find it. I asked about him years ago, after that, but he had the only other Reactionary tape. So I had the one tape, and this cat, a younger man in Pedro named Craig Ibarra, asked to put it out after all these years. It was never supposed to be an album or anything. It was something like to get gigs or something, let people know. It was only 10 of our songs.
Was he able to clean up the sound on the cassette?
Yes. I don't know. It sounds very bad still.
Yeah.
You know, it is for what it is, you know.
And people can get it on your website, or is it in record stores?
No, it's at waterunderthebridgerecords.com.
Oh.
There's links on my website to it, to Craig Ibarra. He put it out. What he did was he put that tape out on one side, and the other side he got some contemporary Pedro young people, musicians, to like redo the songs.
Oh, that's cool. How is it? How are their versions?
They're probably playing better than we are. You know? I don't know. It's
yeah. So where do you go? Where are you going next on your next tour?
Before tour, I go to New York City to finish my third opera.
So, yeah, you mentioned opera. When did you start writing operas?
No, the first one was 97, Contemplating the Engine Room. Kind of wrote for the Minutemen and D. Boone. Mm-hmm. And then 2004 was the second one about that sickness that almost killed me.
What's it called?
Second Man's Mill Stand. And now this third one is Hyphenated Man. Mm-hmm. They all got a different kind of inspiration besides the plot, you know. The first one I used a lot of the Sand Pebbles by Richard McKenna and some Ulysses. Like I put the whole life of our band in a day. Mm-hmm. And then the second one I use Divine Comedy from Dante, the Commedia. And now this third one, I use Hieronymus Bosch. When he got killed, it was hard for me to listen to Minutemen. Boom. So, I didn't. And then there was a documentary made called We Jam Econo. These guys, Tim and Keith. It made in 2005. So they wanted me to talk about the band, and so I had to listen to music again. They had all this live footage people sent them.
Really?
Yeah. There's the whole thing's like 5.5 hours. It's a double DVD.
Yeah.
And so I was listening again to the music, and it was just pretty trippy, all these little songs. So, yeah, my new thing is 30 little songs. And it reminded me of kind of Bosch. This Dutch painter from 500 years ago, he used these little creatures in his things to make up a big work, all these little amalgams of combinations of things, whatever, devils, demons, oni.
Yeah.
And so I thought, whoa, maybe this is kind of like one of our records or one of our gigs. Mm-hmm. And so I went and wrote it on one of his guitars. I showed Tom Watson, and then got Raul Morales in there to play drums with us, and showed him the drum parts, and then I had him record it, just them two, because I didn't want it to be too much like Minutemen, so I thought I'd get rid of the only Minuteman. So now I'm going to go back and put the bass on and finish it.
Have the operas been staged anywhere?
No.
Well, let's stage one of them.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first one was very emotional for me. It had a very sad ending.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it for 14 months, and it was hard for me. emotionally. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was that sickness shit. And even though it was happy ending, I didn't die, it was too much. I did that for 9 months. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I had to relive that every night doing it. So I haven't done either one of those again.
Is it cathartic to do them? Or is it just
I'm glad I did them. I don't know. It hurts a lot. What's it called? Empathy?
Yeah.
Now, hyphenated man is a little bit different. We'll see when I start doing it. But it's more in the moment. It's more about middle age, maybe, or something.
No tragedy.
Punk. Well, one was the happy ending. That's why they call it a commedia. Mm-hmm. But I guess opera is supposed to be tragic. I was talking to Petra about doing a fourth one. Maybe, because everybody's thinking about, I was telling somebody in England about it, you know, and this kind of traditional opera singing. So maybe we do a fourth one and she'll sing like this. She says it's been a long time since she used her opera chops anyway. So we have this thing called Pelican Man, which is bass and violin. And maybe I'll do one like that so people can relate to it. Because I call them operas because they're stories. Mm-hmm. They have beginning, middle, and ends. Although this new one is a little different.
Have it's they almost been all performed middle. With sets and costumes? And
no. Me and my trios. Uh-huh. One was Black Gang. Mm-hmm. The other one was Second Man. Mm-hmm. And no, you just get up there. I'd go up there on the mic and I said, I'm going to play you a really weird long song. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an hour later I'd be done. And, yeah, you know, one thing about coming from old days of punk is I think you just don't care what people think.
It's a great attitude.
So you just put it out there, and if it's terrible, okay. They have every right to think that. But if I compromise too much, I'll end up with...
nothing.
Yeah, very dilute kind of thing. I feel much sorrier for later. So
have the operas been recorded?
Yeah.
Oh.
Both of them on Columbia.
Uh-huh. They're on Columbia?
Yeah.
That's
I was on that label for 14 years.
Wow.
Yeah, they were very nice to me. I mean, the first one, I went up to the building in New York City, 550 Madison. Mm-hmm. They call it 550 Death Star. You know, I would go up to the top floor, and there's the boss, Mr. Einar. And I said, I want it. Do an opera about three guys in a boat.
What did he say?
Well, he had a brother who drives a truck, and we talked about that for a while. And then he said, do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never had to do a demo for those people. Or they were always very nice to me. Yeah. I never took tour support. I never have any big label horror stories.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I don't know why.
Because they're usually not... they're not a philanthropic organization, Columbia.
Their first record company.
I know.
Yeah.
They had Billie Holiday and Bob Dylan. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a great record company.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I was 11 years SST, you know, I'd independent. I just brought over the same things I learned there, right?
And
I didn't expect people to, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Attend me flatter kind of
shit.
You know, I just did what I did, and
they
were very nice to me, and I don't think I have a charm or anything. It wasn't bullshitting them. You know, just
you're pretty charming.
Played what I did.
Don't be coy. You know, you're pretty charming.
Okay. Well, you know, in that racket, there's a lot of hustlers trying to use charm and stuff.
Yeah.
I think they would be... onto that. I don't know what it was, but my first two operas are on there. Mm-hmm. And now, you were saying before, it's different days. It is. Mm-hmm. And so, I'll wait till this is done to find out.
How many records have you put out?
I don't know, a bunch.
Like 30 or something?
And I got a bunch right now in the thing.
Yeah.
Actually, for a few years there, I was doing too many gigs compared with recording. Yeah, I think.
Has Dose made a record?
Yeah, we just got done with our fourth one.
Oh, wow. Okay. It's a lot to keep up with.
Yeah.
What happens when you get tired?
Conk.
For how long?
What do you do? Well, you know, middle age, it's harder to hold pisses.
Yeah.
So it ain't a long time.
Yeah. What's the worst thing about getting older?
The body.
Yeah. You think the brain gets better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the brain is probably worse younger. It's more overconfident and stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know everything.
It's not a bad feeling, really.
Yeah, well, I like this feeling better. Yeah. The body is a little more broken. But I don't want to be young again.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go through all that stupid shit.
Yeah.
Just me personally. I mean, everybody's got their own thing. I would never want to have to go through
that. Yeah, I agree.
Shit I had to go through to be now.
Yeah.
So,
good.
I pushed pretty hard back then, too.
You still do.
And I could handle it. I almost died of pneumonia at 22, though, too hard. I had 3 jobs and school.
Kind of jobs?
And, I was talking to that guy about one of them there. I was a pot and pan boy. I was a meat reader. I was getting the tickets from the Catalina boat. And then I was doing the band, too, and it wore me down, and I got walking pneumonia, and that went into deep pneumonia. It almost killed me.
Were you in the hospital?
Yeah. They had bags of ice between my legs and my arms. And it was the weekend Darby died, John Lennon.
Oh, December 1980.
Yeah. I was 22.
Yeah.
Well, not yet, on the 20th, so it's a couple of weeks away. Mm-hmm. But I got well the next week. You just bounce back when you're that.
Yeah.
And I never even wrote a song about it, but when I was 42 and almost died, I wrote a whole opera.
Yeah.
That was, and it was more stretched out. It was 38 days of fever, and it was just fucked up. It was horrible. But I made it.
We're glad of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want me to play some more music?
Yeah, play some more music.
think you blew me first.
What the fuck you talking about? You blew me first.
Nah, you blew me first.
Nah, wise guy, you blew me first.
Watt from Pedro Show, I played On Our Way to Moving On Our Way by Sagatti. Sagatti's band I'm going to play with Tuesday. and Wednesday. Tuesday with Dose, Wednesday with Missing Men. Dose in Echo Curio, Echo Park. And Missing Men Wednesday in Que Sera, Long Beach. And they're a great band. They're wild. And then I love your... No, You Don't Join. Go and Do What You Please by All For Now. They got the piano player from Chicago. Oh, he ain't from him. Yeah, he's the only one who ain't. He's from San Francisco. And I'm going to do something with him in August. And John Dietrich from Deerhoof. Hmm. And Tim Barnes from Louisville. And then, something from Italy. Defunto by Giovanni Aldopogin. And Italian Fight song by Potty Mouth. I think they're from Hollywood. And then The Voice from the Border by Sachiko. And we're at the end of the second hour of the Lot for Pedro show. May 16, 2010. Hold tight for hour 3.
That's up at Paul Beattie's place.
Yeah, let's talk about it. May 16, 2010. It's the third hour of the Lot for Pedro show. I got Robert Tall Bob here. We're talking about the older days, Wallace Berman. There's a book here.
Right. Christine published that book when he had a show, you know.
Yeah, right. Now you come out, you don't come from San Francisco Bay Area.
No, I come from Wichita.
Yeah,
from
right.
The Vortex.
Charlie Ply Mill.
Yeah. Charlie and I went to the university there when it was Wichita U.
Yeah.
He gives me credit for talking him into it. I guess I did. But, you know, Charlie was some kind of weird existentialist, you know. We used to all take bennies and go to parties and things. And we read books and one thing. You know, we were, i.e., intellectual or something. But anyway, I went to school to study art. And Jim Davis, who Charlie writes about, was a bellboy. I was a bellboy. I've been in reform school, and I got out, and I got a job that was the closest thing I could to being able to steal, which was being a bellboy. But it also sort of taught me humility and to be of service, and it fit into my kind of who's the guy that wrote Guys and Dolls?
The musical?
Yeah.
Frank
Lesser. Now the.
Is that it?
No, it's not Guys and Dolls. It fit into that kind of world, you know, the make-believe gangster world.
Yeah.
David Runyon, yeah. Into that kind of mistaken idea I had about life, which I got from the movies, which had put me in reform school. But anyway, as I'm sort of slowly getting out of that, I had a job as a bellboy.
Yeah.
And the head bell captain was an artist. And he told me, he said, man, I showed him some of my stuff. He said, you ought to come to school. You go to college. I said, no, I went to reform school. I didn't go to high school.
Yeah.
He said, oh, it don't matter. I'll show you how to get around all that. So that's how I went. And then the next year I told Charlie, I said, hey, this place is good. You got to come. And it's, you know, I figured I never learned to read and write, really. And,
yeah.
But I was motivated, so I did all right, you know. And I mostly took art courses. So Charlie said, well, good, I'll try it. Of course, Charlie had to start off with philosophy, you know. And I kind of lied, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, we'd read Nietzsche and, you know, we would read these things and had that kind of stuff going. That was
every young person should read Nietzsche.
They should. Schopenhauer is sort of the one that sort of got me.
Oh, wow.
He's a little negative, you know. He had a bad idea about women, too. But he was smart, too. He knew about space-time coordinates probably before Kant, and he... I had a lot of funny, I don't know, he appealed to my negative thing, because I had that kind of negative, if something will go wrong, it will, you know. He had a little book called Pessimism, so
yeah,
I remember.
Yeah.
I had that at reform school, it was my Bible, you know.
Yeah, that's a good reform school Bible.
Yeah.
So how'd you make your way to West?
Well, Alan Russo, the poet, who was also in school, had been here, and he knew Mike McClure and Connors and the people who had come earlier. And he was always telling us about it, so I got drafted into the Army in I can't even remember the year, 1958 or 59. And I made a deal with them. I went and, you know, they accepted me and were going to put me in the war. But I said, if you let me go to Mexico to go to school, Jim Davis had told me about this school, then I'll go to the Army. And they said, okay, you can go. So I was on the way to Mexico. I went to San Francisco. And it was sort of at the height of the thing, you know.
Kansas to Mexico, yeah. Via San Francisco.
Yeah, via San Francisco.
That's the most direct.
And they still had sawdust on the floor, and beers were still 15 cents. And you didn't want to
drive through Texas.
Yeah, well, I've been to Texas. We used to go to Texas all the time. You know, Amarillo to pick girls up or whatever, you know. But anyway, so I was in San Francisco, and I met Dave Hazelwood and McClure, and Ginsberg just happened to be there. And so, you know, the whole beat thing sort of inspired me. And I wrote all these letters back to my wife at the time. And while I was in Mexico, she packed up and moved us to San Francisco. So that's how I actually got moved.
Oh, wow. She moved there without you being there.
She did. The last letter I got was, I'll be on the road. We're moving there. Alden Russo had came and helped her. And I went there a little before Charlie did. In the meantime, they had Alden's father, who was a psychiatrist, write a letter to the draft board saying I had been in prison and I was part gay. And if I was separated from my wife, I'd probably kill the wrong people. And so they sent me a letter saying, you're out of the Army, man. You're screwed up. We don't want you in the Army. I used to have it framed. I wish I still had that. It's lost. But
the Stooges guys all had to do that.
Yeah.
They never even got in. It was right at the thing where they check you out. This guy told me about wearing war paint and being all wasted and stuff. You know, they'd have to put on these scenes
that they were
out of their heads to not get in.
Yeah.
So, you're in San Francisco, you're free of the service?
I'm free of the service, and I was around all those people, McClure and Bruce Connors, who was a big influence. He lived two blocks from me, Bruce and I.
Wow.
Saw each other. Dave Hazelwood had the Arhon Press, and he was publishing all those guys. He had just finished Philip LaMantia's book, Stasis, which had a picture of him shooting up heroin on the cover. Of course, at that time, that was a pretty far out cover. Wally did the pictures, Wallace Berman. And I was doing the first time I met Ginsberg, I was doing a print at Dave's shop.
Was that for work? That's what you were doing for work?
Well, I was just doing it to help.
Oh, for fun.
You know, for
yeah,
fun.
For art.
And that's how I met Ginsberg. He was in there. I said, oh, that's some really great artwork, you know, or whatever. You know, he and Peter were there. But I didn't get to hang out with him until later after that. But did you ever have trouble with the law, Mike?
I had some trouble.
You had a little, yeah. Well, I don't mean to pry into that. But anyway, by having gone to reform school, I realized that it wasn't like in the movies, you know. It wasn't quite as romantic. You know, I decided I didn't need to be on the wrong side of the law. But, San Francisco was a great time at that time, 1959.
Was Charlie on the docks then?
No, Charlie hadn't come. He came a few years later. I'm not sure. He might have been there before. Charlie, sometimes when I read his things, I'm not sure. His viewfinder and mine are a little tilted, you know. But, you know, whatever.
No, Christina was talking about I Need More. And when I asked Ronnie about that book, he said, yeah, he remembers different.
Yeah, I think we all have our own viewfinder. Charlie's the writer and the historian, so I just let him go. I don't ever say anything. But he gives me credit for a few things, like we're in jail together drinking oxybiotic. They came out with this cough syrup. It was called oxybiotic that if you drank that, it was like taking about 10 Black Beauties or something. You know, it had so much benzodrine in it, it was no boom. You know, you were just, and talk about paranoid, you look like a Big Al, you've been up for two or three days, you know.
Did you, on the road book, they're chewing inhalers.
Yep.
Did you chew inhalers?
Yes, I did. Wyomine inhalers, nasal. There was two or three of them. They'd stopped the old Benzedrine, but they still had some. And you smelled, you could smell someone that was chewing them way off because they stunk. They had this other chemical in them, you know, like ether or, menthol and weird things. You know.
It would leach through their skin.
Oh, it was, yeah, you would start smelling like that after a few days. I was just looking for, I knew something was wrong with me, or I felt there was. And I was looking for something to make me normal. I figured it was I had a chemical imbalance, and I would someday find that chemical, and I'd be a balanced person.
Ah.
And I kept finding it every
you
once in a while.
Kept finding it.
Yeah. But it wasn't Benzedrine. That was totally the last. That I think I had my early LSD experiences on Benzedrine. You know, after about, you've been up for 3 or 4 days, and you're hearing your mother talk to the police on the phone, and the white guys in the ambulance are waiting outside with the coats to put you in, and you're looking out the window, all
very those, romantic.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm glad all that's gone.
Yeah.
Well, not quite all of it, but...
What about the L scene, the early there in town?
In San Francisco? Yeah. Well, that was actually a great scene.
Yeah,
I mean, there were drugs, but not hard drugs. There was methadrine. There was an alley called Amp Alley, because early methadrine was in amps, and you break the amp and drink it or shoot it. And there were a lot of meth heads, and so they threw these things. You'd walk through there, it'd be crunch, crunchy, you'd be walking all over these little amps. But outside of that, it's like you would score a matchbox of pot. That's a whole ounce was unheard of. Or maybe a lid. They used to actually put it in lids in Prince Albert cans. They called that a lid. And
because they filled it to the lid. You didn't weigh them. It was so terrible.
I remember my first connection was Alan Watts's secretary, this guy, and we could get matchboxes of pot to him. We also got peyote too. I thought peyote was pretty cool. But,
So what about the LSD?
Well, it hadn't come around
yet.
Okay. It finally did, and it really blew my mind. I mean, it wasn't for me. I had a similar reaction. Burroughs and Ginsberg sort of both talked about that. I don't know what it is. I think maybe some people that have taken opiates don't do well with LSD. But I had experiences like my skin is crawling with bugs, and I'm being crucified, and there's all these Egyptian hieroglyphs on the wall, and I can read them. But I don't care. I don't want to be there.
Never did art on it.
Well, it influenced it. I mean, everything that comes in your life influences it. But no, I didn't
do
art.
Do you think some people work better on it?
I think their art
on it?
Well, I think later it did more. I went back to San Francisco with them Big Sur. I got away, and moved to Big Sur. But when I went back, in the middle of the sort of the hippie era, then people were taking a lot of acid and doing a lot of things. I think that door had been opened by earlier people, the old beatnik guys like Hunk Heath in New York, or the old dope fiends and the old, before beatniks, the bohemians. But the door was opened by people looking for consciousness, not necessarily to get out of things and get high. I remember Janice, when I hung out with her, we threw a dance in Monterey one time with Big Brother and the Holy Company.
Yeah.
And Janice had the idea that you didn't have to suffer the pains of reality. You fell a little down, you took it up, you fell a little up, you took it down.
Yeah.
And a lot of people had that idea then, and of course that idea don't work. The older idea was more like, we're doing this for a spiritual reason, and we're trying to find higher consciousness and transform our consciousness. And
were the people you met like that? Was Leary like that, or was it?
Well, Leary was a whole other hybrid kind of thing. He was sort of a combination of a lot of things. Yeah, he had that kind of thing going. He wanted to turn the whole world on, and I met him when I was in Big Sur. He came through there. He invited me up to Millbrook and things, and it sort of scared me. I mean, it was.
Yeah.
I was around them when they. But that's during that period I quit taking drugs altogether. I mean, I smoked a little grass maybe or something, but I quit taking. But I was around them when they would take acid and things. But we used to drink and plot on taking over the world. I mean, Larry had a great mind. He was a great comedian. I loved him. Yeah. Now, it was an interesting time, all those people, you know.
Well, who was the guy who was with Ram Dass, Albert?
Yeah, he was there, too. He was Richard Albert's.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's suffered some strokes. I guess he's not doing so good. Yeah. The last time he was at the Shrine, I wanted to go see him and say hello, but it was so many people, and, you know, I didn't go backstage and do that. But, no, he's a brilliant man. He changed that book of his, Be Here Now. Wow. I mean, that kind of thing. I saw him after he got back from India a couple of times, you know.
You saw a lot of that East stuff coming in, right?
Yeah, yes. and I joined it.
Yeah, right.
In 1970.
How far was Kerouac trying to, like, make a hybrid?
Well, poor Jack just had...
Drink.
But he was a Buddhist and one of the first American Buddhists.
But it seems kind of Catholic, too. Was he kind of mixing them?
Well, he had that kind of thing. I mean, Neil told me some stories, Neil Cassidy, you know. He said the last time he went to Jack's house, and Jack was there with his mother, and he had the television on, excuse me, and with the sound off and classical music playing, and on the coffee table he had about 10 brochures of mental institutions and nut houses, and he was checking them out and deciding where he was going to go. And he was drinking a fifth of some kind of whiskey. And Neil said that he came in and started rolling joints and said, well, here's Betty and Mary, and come in here to the bedroom, and blah, 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 and I want you to meet Barry, and here's the joint, you know. And Jack said, Neil, you don't understand. I got guys with Kerouac on their leather jackets jumping over my back gate. You don't understand. I mean, no, I don't want Mary. No, I don't want the joint. No. But anyway, and the end of the story was Jack's mother told them to leave. Now, I don't know if that's a true story or not. It probably is, because Neil told me. And I was talking to Ginsberg about it, and he said, I don't want to hear stories about Neil Cassidy. Burroughs and I started the Beatniks. You know, we're the ones, you know, I mean, all those guys, you know, they were so close and so instrumental in starting all of that.
Yeah. I thought the Burroughs book, Naked Lunch, I thought that came from Kerouac.
Well, Kerouac was one of the people. No, I mean, Burroughs was
older.
He told
me he named it.
True. Well, he was one of the characters. They were all influenced each other. Yeah. We used to read that book at Hazelwood's, Arahant Press, and it was just letters from Morocco or Tangiers or something. Right. And then they published some of it in the Chicago Review, and they broke the Chicago Review. I mean, they kicked all those guys off the paper for doing that, you know. And they started then a group called Big Table, which was printed. I think Evergreen published that. And that was like sort of the height of the writing, you know. Robert Creeley, all those early, you know, Kenneth Patch, and all those early really great poets, Ferlinghetti, McClure, Philip Whalen, all those guys were in those things. None of my poetry ever made. The poets always said to me, I used to write poetry. Oh, you're not really a poet. Stick to painting, you know.
Well, they were kind of characters, huh?
Still characters. Yeah, McClure was one of my favorite poets. He was from Kansas, you know.
Yeah.
And Charlie was a poet, and still, you know, a major poet, major brilliant person, you know.
Did you know him with the comics?
How do you mean?
The Zap.
Yeah, I sort of helped. I was around when we did that first thing. Yeah, he did some things of mine, those Robert Ronnie Brennerman things.
How did it come about?
Well, he met this guy, Ralph Ackerman, who promoted this storefront in the Mission on maybe 16th Street or something, and he bought an old Maldolive press. And Charlie, who had been a printer, even back in Kansas, he was a printer at Wesley Hospital. It's funny, because there were two jobs that were given, and one was painting a mural, and I took that job, and the other was running a printing press at Wesley Hospital, and Charlie took that job. And we got those jobs out of the university. You know, they would give you jobs. We needed work. And anyway, he learned how to run a press, you know, and he was a printer. So he published my book, Fucks, F-U-X.
Yeah, yeah.
And he published that first Zap comic book with Donahue, yeah. And he published a lot of things. We made a lot of posters and things of mine and things.
Was the idea just to do it because I can do it?
Hey, we got a press. Yeah, we're doing it. I made that movie with Ferlinghetti there, mm-hmm. too. There's one little scene that was shot in the middle of there. I don't know if you... Did you see the movies the other day?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, those girls, when they were sipping and taking showing their breasts, back in those days, if you made a movie and you showed girls' breasts, it was probably going to be a hit just because you didn't see that too often or whatever. But that was in the impressions, yeah. That was in that little thing there. Finally, Ferlinghetti got mad and banged on the door and said, "This is my movie. I want to be in it." You know, I was in there with the girls, but so he came in and you see him sort of briefly. Well, he's the star of the movie. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
No, that was a great place. And Ralph, I understand, just died not too long ago.
Oh.
But he was a filmmaker. He made this documentary of Charlie's, about Charlie, that went on for years, maybe 10, 15 years. I don't know if it ever got finished or what. You know? I mean, and he told me a story. He said there's this one movie he made. It was called Fuckface, which was... it was of Judy Scrooby, who was also in some of my movies, sitting on top of Charlie doing it. And so that was just her face. But Charlie had somehow got a hold of this and had it, the filmmakers co-op and stuff, he'd been getting the money for it for years, you know, and Ralph was a little upset about that. It was his movie. But, anyway, that was back in the day. Charlie and I always have, and I don't know, you'll probably hear this and give me grief, but we always had this thing of, it seemed like he ended up with my girls, and he was always thinking I ended up with his girls. So there was this this thing. But the truth is, he always got all the girls. He looked like Marlon Brando, and he didn't have to say anything. He just sort of grunted, you know. And they go, "Oh, okay, they're off to the bedroom," you know. And I was like, me, I would talk forever. I mean, girls would finally say, "I'll screw you if you'll shut up." But what did I know? But Charlie didn't always treat them well, so that was, you know, I used to pass on his girls because I was afraid, I knew he would get all upset, you know, but his casts off were everywhere, you know. Anyway, that's another story.
Let's play some music.
you were helping me play for the movie the other day at my show. The very thought I had was, I wish I could pick up my cello and play with Mike. Then we would get
your
something
cello
going.
Player.
Well, I played bass, and then I went to the cello.
Is that right?
It's in fifths instead of fourths.
Right. Jumps are more dramatic.
I mean, I finally learned the scale of things, but when I had my band with a very short-lived band, the Gladstones, but...
Is it named after that guy in Ireland?
No, it was...
Gladstone was...
Yeah.
Some guy for Ireland to somehow work out a deal with England through Parliament. And
right. No, I had a Gladstone bag.
Okay.
That,
oh.
Plus our motto was, we're glad we're stoned. but it was back in the day. I threw a dance once with Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company and Quicksilver Messenger Service and our group, the Gladstones.
In the city?
Yeah, no, it was in Monterey. The
Monterey
Fairgrounds.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I sent you a poster for it. It was.
Oh, that's right. That's from that gig, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was the year before the Pops
Fest. I got to
Festival.
Play once there, the 2005 Monterey Pop Fest.
Yeah, we hired the guy, the sound guy that knew the system, because we were going to, you know, he was, what, 300 or something. Janis was 150, and you know, $150 a night, the whole band. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. But
you spend that, not even a tenth of the catering at these rock stars.
I know. They had to drive down there on their own and stuff. Me and Sam Post put that band. I did the poster, and Sam did a lot of the promotion and stuff.
You know that I really like that. But when the Full Tilt Boogie Band after, that is good.
Yeah.
There's something, Big Brother was wild, I like.
Big Brother was wild, yeah. Then Bill Graham came and told Janis, you don't need
these
guys.
That's what happened.
Yeah, you don't need these guys. We're going to make it with strings and the whole, yeah.
And Quicksilver.
Yeah, and Quicksilver.
The Italian guys.
Yeah.
There were a bunch of Italian guys.
I was supposed to put Cipollina. Them. Yeah, I was supposed to put them up in housing.
Yeah.
And they didn't like it. They went to Garapata where they had their friends and stayed in Big Sur, yeah.
Wow.
But we did a two-day concert, you know, over the 4th of July. And the police had never seen anything like this. They were like, you know. And I saw Janis at one time. She's talking to one of the lady cops. Talking something about hold the orange too close, you see things, hold it fire. I mean, I don't know what she was at. The cop was like, whoa. She had never heard anything.
She was tapping, probably.
She was something else, really. I had
from
a
Texas,
kind of...
Texas, right?
Hmm?
From Texas, I think, by Louisiana.
Yeah, she was. She used to...
Pearl?
She came with a guy... who died recently. He used to be the sound man at the Winterland. He worked for Bill Graham, and she came with him. And the first time I saw her was in San Francisco at the right on Grant Street. She was singing a cowboy song, and everyone was saying, shut up, sit down, just because it was the material, you know.
Yeah.
But the minute you heard her voice, you knew she had that Nellie Letcher or some kind of far out thing.
R&B.
Yeah. I had this thing happen where I was, you know, I was starting to tell you about my story of playing with Donald, which I'll get back to, but I had this thing where I was walking in front of the stage. It was about this high.
Yeah.
And I wasn't paying any attention to her. She was up there doing her thing, you know. And I was thinking about getting to the sound man, about Mike and the cello to up the sound. You know, I was thinking about something totally different. I'm walking by, and her sound just grabbed me. And it's like I stopped for a minute, and like tears or something of joy and whatever came out. Because it just grabbed, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
it was one of those
moments.
And I had to stop and listen to her a while. And then the past I went on. But, no, she was...
Music's weird that way. It's happened to me where you just tears come out.
Yeah, it just the
connection is so direct.
Well, she had she really wanted to lay it on you, and she did. I mean, you can't get it on records. Well, you had to be there sort of see her.
Die in Hollywood, right?
I heard that. Yeah, it's funny because she was in Big Sur, and she was up at Pat Cassidy's house, and she wanted to get here to L.A. And we told her, don't go. You've been beaten up, and it's, you know.
Yeah.
And we talked about the whole Bill Graham thing and all that. And And she couldn't drive, but she had a car. So old Jim, I forget his last name, he said, "I'll drive you." And he didn't drive. He drove right in the ditch. So, but anyway, she called somebody. I got somebody. They towed her out, and she made it. And that's the last we heard of her. I heard, right around the same time Jimi Hendrix died. Yeah. September, I think it was. Yeah. Neil Cassidy, too. He came through. He'd been on the bus, you know.
Mexico?
Well, before that, just before that, he'd been with Ken Kesey, and they'd been doing all this stuff. And I had a place in Big Sur in Gorda. And I had an extra little cabin thing that a neighbor had who was gone. I was taking care of it. So I told Neil and his girlfriend that they could stay there and, hang out, mellow out. And he didn't have any drugs or anything. I had some Dolophine at that time. I'd been drinking cough syrup, and that had got taken off the market. So I had a little edge, and I found a doctor that gave me Dolophine, which later became methadone. But anyway, I had these pills, and so every day Neil would come up, and we'd smoke some of that old raggy weed and eat some pills. I would give him some of the pills. And after about a week, he came up one morning. I said, "Well, here's one of the pills." He said, "I'd rather be dead than live like this." And anyway, he split. But he needed people, He was a very people person, and I was trying to tell him mellow out, It takes a while, but if you'll just stay here in Big Sur, and we'll go visit people. He already had cabin fever. But people have to do what they have to do,
Yeah.
They had a gig, and. He liked to be going. Like Charlie's poem really catches him well.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah.
That was a good one. Yeah, because you know what I've done with reading like some stuff when I was younger or more young? I reread again in a book like On the Road when I read it again in my late 40s. It seemed very much sadder than when I read it when I was more young. Ulysses too. The words didn't change, they're the same, but I hear a different voice. It seemed like Kerouac was really bumming on him a little bit.
Yeah.
For leaving him.
Yeah, well, it's all a sort of a Ulysses story. I mean, we're all going out and fighting the wars and coming back. The great hero goes out, leaves the vortex.
Sallies forth.
Joseph Campbell had it. I mean, that...
Yeah, my ma likes him, the myth of the hero.
Yeah. You have to go out and fight the demons, and then hopefully you can bring it back, or find the gold, or unite your principles, whatever. Marry the princess or the queen.
Or conk head to toe, like him and Molly. Let her get the last word.
Well, Kansas had that, the vortex thing, McClure and Bruce Connors and Charlie. Everyone sort of argues about who started it or what it's about. But if you notice in the United States, Wichita is right sort of...
Shut up.
Yeah. Or as they used to call it, the asshole of the world.
Yeah. But, okay.
It's like culture comes in sort of from the coast and gets there sort of last. But yet there's some kind of primal power there or energy.
Sure.
That creates, like you were saying, a lot of those artists were from the Midwest.
And,
A lot of artists came from there. But
it's funny, with young people, kind of inferiority complex about the Midwest. They want to get out as quick as possible.
Want to get out, right? Find the place. That's like I said, the movies had been an influence. I wanted to live like in the movies,
Right.
Well, that's. That's a myth, but...
somebody once told me, wherever you go, there you are.
There you are, right, yeah.
But a lot of young people I notice can live in a town 2 years, 3 years, go to the next town. Yeah, they're much braver than me.
Yeah, they call those geographics, yeah.
Those are geographics.
Right. I heard a guy give an AA pitch once, and it was all about his geographics. He moved from Silver Lake to here, to there, then to Camarillo, and then, this nut house. And that.
Yeah, I was going to say there's a sick house in Camarillo.
Right. Yeah, there's a great jazz song. By some
there's
brother.
A good Fear song.
Yeah.
Right, Jordan? You know Camarillo. First First I fell down and I got up again. We just love it here. It's so fucking therapeutic.
The Wilcox Hotel's got to be on that.
Man, did you know Charlie when he lived on the worked on the docks?
I knew him before. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But during, he told me that was one of his favorite jobs. And he said he was teaching on the East Coast. He said that was much more hell.
Oh, I bet.
Than working on the docks.
Yeah. Well, I told you I went to the wheat harvest for them one of the years we were studying, and you know, he was a farm guy. His father, I told you about his father, and. And so I was sort of the greenhorn, even though I grew up around farms and things, but I wasn't like Charlie, just jump right on a tractor and take off. And, you know, I had to sort of, well, wait a minute, which gear is which or whatever, you know. But, yeah, it was fun. Charlie was he was the boss of that scene. I mean, he knew much more about it than me. Yeah.
Have you been to Cherry Valley?
No, I've never been there. I should go. I want to go sometime.
I've never been there either.
Yeah. I just met somebody... recently, said he was there, said it was a great place. You know, he used to have these festivals every year, you know, poetry festivals. I've got some books, you know, where different poets, they all read, you know, and they were doing a celebration for Ginsberg, too, ever so often, because Ginsberg was real close. He had a place. And, of course, they have the publishing thing there, too, you know, the Cherry Valley Press. And, yeah, I need to get out there. I sent him a poster. I sent him a Barbertal Bob.
Yeah.
Yeah, he told me I should read that poem, but it's a little too self. Charlie wrote this poem about me called Barbertal Bob, and that actually, I didn't take Barbertals, but the police, every time they would arrest me, and it seemed like they always did, because once they get you, they keep doing that. And they'd say, what are you on? Barbitols, I bet. And I was there. I wasn't on nothing. I would have been if I could have found it. But
Barbitol is a heavy down.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I hate Barbitols. Yeah, but anyway, I got that name, Barbitol Bob.
Yeah.
And later I had a name, Ball Bat Bob, because they were at a bar one time and they were all sort of messed up and doing something weird, and all the hillbillies decided they would just kill them. You know, we'd been up on bennies for days. Yeah. So, no, I had a ball bat in the car, so I came in with the ball bat.
And saved the day.
Yeah, so that's how I got the name Ball Bat. I don't know if I really hit anyone, but Charlie, he's remained my closest, oldest friend, you know. Which is great to have somebody from college and things. You know?
From the older days.
Yeah, every once in a while I get somebody on Facebook from 30 years ago or something, but nobody from all of that, you know.
And
I even joined one of those things where are they now kind of, you know, things that you have to pay money for on the web, and you find all the things I typed in, they didn't exist anymore. I mean, I was born in 1933. So.
Yeah.
That's
a little bit.
Yeah. The end of 33. So it's really December, so I'm 76, yeah.
Well, you're older than Charlie.
Hmm?
You're a little bit older than him.
Yeah, I'm a little older than Charlie, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. I'm lucky I haven't had those heart attacks yet, but
he's healed up though with some, huh?
He's survived, yeah. He's a strong presence. The last time I saw him was in Kansas.
Because that's a year and 3 months or something.
Yeah.
Or four months, 16 months.
He lost a little weight. He got George, what's George's name? Lawhead.
Yeah.
He corresponds. And he's trying to get us something back in Kansas again.
Because that's where he's at.
Yeah. The last time we had it, the museum did a thing.
He's not from your generation, though. He's a younger man.
No, he's a little younger. Yeah. But he's from the academic generation.
Right.
So he could maybe put it together. S.A. Griffin tried to do something like that. But it got too big. You know, he had 20 poets and people that were all going to go to camp. We would have ended up in jail, part of us, or whatever.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you think about it, but then they're very staid in a way.
Yeah,
you know?
And, of course.
But then they also, you know, they have great art departments and they have appreciation for art, but it's just on a, it's, well, you know, you've been out in the Midwest.
Yeah, Kansas always played Lawrence.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a hipper town with a college and all. Lawrence, yeah. They put Burroughs up, which was something.
Yeah.
And they loved him, and the university took care of him. And
good basketball, too.
Huh?
Good basketball, too.
Yeah.
No, I like playing. There's a club there called the Bottleneck. I've played like 20 times.
Wow.
But I, in the old days, in Minutemen days, there was a club called the Outhouse. And it was in a cornfield. So if you had the gig in the fall, it was kind of hard to find. Well, you couldn't find all the stocks. And then in the springtime gig, it'd be all cleared and very easy to see from. It was a roadhouse in the old days when you couldn't have a club in the town.
That's right. That's the way Kansas is,
A lot of the country is that way.
Yeah.
Early punk was that way with rock and roll clubs. They didn't want us, so we played a lot of ethnic halls, Ukrainian, Italian, Polish hall, BFW club, Knight of Columbus, gay bars, clean bathrooms. They didn't have prejudice. The rock and roll people just did not want us playing. I'm talking big town, New York City, Peppermint Lounge or Danceteria. You couldn't play a rock club.
No.
Gay discos.
Yeah.
So these roadhouses, too, happened.
And yeah, the
you could tell these things were from a long time ago.
Yeah, that was the old days, yeah.
Well, you couldn't even have them in the town.
Because the bars had to close at 11 or 12, and liquor stores not open on Sunday or Saturday, maybe.
I think they just didn't want it in town. I played this place, you were saying, Amarillo.
Yeah.
There was a Nautica. Well, it was an indoor swimming pool. And Little Richard played there in 58.
Yeah.
And got arrested for taking his shirt off.
right. Arrested for taking his shirt off. Yeah. Black man takes shirt off.
That's when I started touring. Christine was asking me about that. And my pop, you know, his people was from Arkansas. And when he saw these gigs I played, he couldn't believe it. He didn't know that things, even for fucked up as it was.
Yeah.
There's nothing compared to those older days. I can imagine Jerry Lee and Little Richard and these guys having to tour these places. And even in the 60s, I can imagine.
Yeah, Charlie and
Joe in Mobile, he used to run Mota and the Vans, and he told me about that crazy-ass shit. I told Pop, man, we got it easy. A lot easier, you know. We had to deal with just some aesthetic questions with these stupid rock and roll people. These people had the whole society had just a weird idea.
Well, when I was young, like with Charlie, we liked jazz, so we would go to the clubs where there would be 200 black people and we'd be four or five white people, you know, and hear Fats Domino or Ray Charles or somebody, or people before them, because and when I was in San Francisco, right on Fillmore or something, there'd be T-Bone Walker and a little bitty dive. I mean, I kind of have a little cafeteria here, a little, you know, like counter, food counter, and then a few drinks back here. But the whole thing was about this big. But there's T-Bone Walker or some of those guys. Yeah. Yeah, there used to be great music in Kansas. Yeah, there was quite a few saxophone players and people. Charlie and I used to hang out at the Zip Club.
The other side, Kansas City, that's where Charlie Parker's from.
Right.
East St. Louis is Miles Davis.
I saw Billie Holiday in Kansas City.
I think Lester Young was Kansas City, too.
Yeah. He came to Kansas once, and he had a gig, and we all went to see him. He came out on the stage and blew a couple of notes. Dropped his saxophone over the hollered and truck it off the stage and walked off. That was it.
Wow.
And Lester was not feeling well. Everyone got all pissed off and wanted to.
You have the pork pie hat?
Yeah. No, he didn't have a hat.
He didn't have a pork
pie. Or he might have. I'm trying to remember. He's but I know we were all upset. He just made a couple of notes. And
sure. I saw something like that with Johnny Thunders, but. he just went out.
Well, Lester got sort of holed up.
He just, I
don't know. There's been stuff written about it, but it's too bad that he didn't have people there to help him, you know, get out of the shell or something, the isolation he was in.
Billy, too.
Yeah.
She died lonely.
I know.
Crazy.
Well, there wasn't much understanding back in those days.
No.
Those are two great musicians.
Christine asked about John Colt. How old was he? 40 years old.
They
lived hard.
Yeah, I didn't.
I thought we lived hard.
I didn't get to see Coltrane, but I told you I had a bass player. Raphael Garrett had played with Coltrane.
Yeah.
And
but there was a place up there he used to play. Nighthawk?
Nighthawk.
Yeah, because I know cats, some Memphis guys, Herman Green and Calvin Newborn, they told me about seeing him there. He was a tripper.
Yeah, he was
intense, very quiet man. But and you know, and for a while there, there was a guy who opened a thing called the Church of St. John Coltrane. He was there on Divisadero. It's in Hunters Point now. And I went to some of the services. It'd be like 3 hours. His name, Bishop Franzo or something, comes out there in a frock and with a tenor, and he starts John Coltrane for 3 hours. I brought my organ player once. He came up to Pete and he says, "We're going to go to work." And his son's on the drums, and he's got his daughter on the bass, and his girl's daughter and wife singing with him, and like kind of chanting, but to Coltrane. They start out with Lonnie's Lament.
Yeah.
It was just 3 hours. He had a little gospel at the end. It was sort of like, you know, common sense stuff, not really guilt stuff, but mainly it was just jamming on his music. And like Coltrane wasn't the guy. They had all these like icon things, but he was just the bringer of the fire. He wasn't like the god. He was just some messenger guy.
Yeah.
So it was a neat thing about it. I guess he went to a gig and it just blew his mind. So some Orthodox African church, and they let him have a kind of an affiliation or something. I saw him too when they lost that storefront, and they were the Lutheran church gave him a thing. How do you say it? Golf.
Oh, was that the Glade?
There was a church right there. But yeah. Did Charlie live on that street?
He did. He lived right on Gulf Street. But the one we're talking about is more down towards the Tenderloin.
It's
right in the Tenderloin. And that guy took that church, I went to it once. Talk about tears shoot out of your eyes. They're jabbed. You know, I mean, it became huge. There's like hundreds of people. And they play a lot of music, and then suddenly someone gets up and said, "Yeah, and I have AIDS, and I was in prison for 20 years, and now I'm saved, and hallelujah."
I mean, you
hear some stories.
Tenderloin is still really intense.
Yeah, but the music.
What was it like in those days, in the 60s?
The what?
Tenderloin.
Oh, the Tenderloin, yeah.
Was it always...
It's always been intense. I stayed away from it. We hung out in North Beach, the Tenderloin. I had this girlfriend who had a place there, and the guy next door to her died, and she kept complaining about the smell.
Yeah.
You know? And they didn't do anything. She's an artist. She's having a show with Fraser, Honor Fraser, coming up. Shiri Mordechai is her name. But anyway, she ended up taking some of those special kind of flies that show up when someone's dead and making a whole piece with the flies. She used it in her art, but she said all her clothes and all her stuff, she had to move. You know, it was like just too... They finally found the guy dead there.
That's funny you speak about that because, you know, you're talking about the jail stuff, and I had to do some community service at a morgue, at County Morgue, right by where they saved me. And like, you know, there's maggots coming out of these bodies. I got to wash off the trays and their ropes and their gowns. And there's these guys I'm working with, you know, that have got the honor, the privilege to serve alongside. And then, see, when you die, they finally get a chance to come out. And like, I just tried to say, no, you know, some flies laid their eggs there. And like, the maggots are always in us. And they're just waiting for us to die. So they get to come out. I didn't want to argue. They were so intense about it. I was like, okay. That's why we stay alive. Keep the maggots in there.
Was it some philosopher had about a maggot in each ear, and they used to argue or something? It might have been Claudio Dorado or one of those guys. I don't know. He's always talking about the maggot this year.
I know there's some maggots that they use if you get a burn and stuff. They know how to. It's okay.
Yeah.
I'm doing a radio show. I love Supreme. bothering. I hardly get, my sister got me this because she got tired of circling the airport to pick me up from the tour.
Right.
I call it the leash.
Yeah, I had one for a while, and then I don't use it, you know, so I keep having to pay for it. I said, finally, I let it go, you know, but...
You cut off some of their revenue stream.
I know. It got crazy. You were seeing homeless people with cell phones. You're like, why? I'm really behind the times here. I can't afford a cell phone. I don't have a cell phone.
Thank you for talking to me, Bob.
Oh, thanks for coming in and hanging out.
Christine, thanks for talking with me. Laurie, for making all this happen. All you people for coming. It's... been May 16, 2010, Juan from Pedro show. Keep your powder dry.